Hello and welcome to the next in our series of podcasts for the Centre for Brexit Studies. Today we'll be discussing some of the findings from our first year as a research facility and what these could mean for the future of the UK and its relationship with the European Union. I'm joined by Centre Director Alex de Ruyter.
Hello there.
And Research Assistant David Hearn.
Hi.
Hello Alex and David, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Jess.
Thanks.
Now, I know we've already collated our top 10 things we've learned about Brexit since the centre opened. So for the benefit of our listeners, would you both like to announce these?
Well, we'll count down from 10 to number one, Jess. So in 10th place, we found that, in many ways not surprising, but still to be played out, the impact of Brexit is likely to have a substantial regional dimension with varied effects across different regions of the UK. So if we're in the city of London, for example, of paramount importance at the moment is whether financial services firms will still continue to enjoy passporting rights into the EU should we leave the single market. Whereas here in the West Midlands, where we are, manufacturing, of course, is of the utmost importance. And key companies desire, Jaguar Land Rover, for example, to ensure that we continue to have frictionless access to the mainland if we are not indeed part of a customs union.
So following on from that point, number nine, we point out that the economic impact of Brexit so far remains unclear, although obviously there's been a large effect on sterling, which depreciated by around 10% in the immediate aftermath of the referendum. Although there's been some recovery vis-a-vis the US dollar recently, that is as much to do with dollar weakness as sterling strength. Against the euro, the sterling is, the pound is more or less unchanged since the beginning of the year. So in terms of the broader economic impact, we don't yet know. Some academic analysis suggests a negative impact. I've seen a number of estimates and a number of different modelling techniques applied to that, but others are more sanguine, so I think we're really waiting for that to be played out.
That's a very interesting point, David. Of course, in terms of economic impact, studies have tried to quantify what the estimated cost to the rest of the EU would be. So in terms of Oxford Economics, for example, recently commissioning a study, they suggest that up to $125 billion could be knocked off the UK economy by 2020, as opposed to approximately $90 billion for the rest of the EU. Now, whilst those numbers might sound pretty much the same, the rest of the EU is a trade bloc of about 400 million people, with 27 countries to scatter those purported effects over. So of clear importance here in terms of the economic impact is that the UK is much smaller than the rest of the EU, so it's not an effect amongst equals. Any damage to the UK economy proportionally will be far bigger than that to the rest of the EU.
The only exception, of course, is Ireland.
Yes. In terms of number eight then, from our findings, the UK government of course says it's open to independent arbitration, because in terms of Theresa May's red lines, of course, we are told by the government that it wishes to see the European Court of Justice, otherwise known as the Court of Justice of the European Union, not have the final say in any arbitration should any future trade-related disputes arise between the UK and the EU. So it says it's open to independent arbitration if any differences of opinion emerge. But of course, in reality, the UK would still be subject to some form of supranational arbitration, which to all intents and purposes would mean the Court of Justice of the European Union, and indeed in the agreement reached so far between the UK and EU negotiators, the key statement in there, of course, is that going forward, the UK will have due regard to any decisions made by the Court of Justice of the European Union. Now, what does that mean in real terms? To reiterate the point, we will still be subject to some form of supranational arbitration. And of course, with the present system of being an EU member, we do actually contribute to how those decisions are made. We have an equal say with all the other countries in that regard. And of course, we may recall that Article 50 was actually written by a British judge, Lord Kerr. In contrast, if we were to go and try and join something like a purported Trans-Pacific Partnership, the supranational jurisdiction would be far less transparent. In other words, an open court where parties can openly argue their case would be replaced in all likelihood by a closed system of investor-state dispute resolution panels. In other words, people not accountable to wider democratic mechanisms. and countries which have trade agreements such as Canada and the US under the NAFTA. Canada, of course, the Canadian government is the most sued government in the developed world for allegedly breaching contract with companies operating under that trade agreement, because the Canadian government, for example, might wish to limit the harmful effects of advertising, say, tobacco. These are the things we need to consider should we leave the EU, leave the single market and the customs union, and try and negotiate trade deals with the rest of the world. Far from take back control, control nowadays at best means shared sovereignty. We'll have to share it with someone, regardless of whatever trade association we enter into.
Absolutely. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, has revealed that there is still no agreed position in Cabinet of what the endpoint of negotiations should be. So in practice, the government remains quite divided on this issue. There's still a very noticeable political divide within the governing Conservative Party between Brexiteers and Remainers. And we see actually at the front, in the front pages of the newspapers today, that that is now being played out. Personally, I think there will be a few monumental arguments within the Cabinet going forward.
Well, we really are reaching crunch time in terms of the negotiations with the EU, so to the extent that the government has any say in the matter, in all likelihood, it will try and leave any detail to conversations to be had during a transition period. To the extent that the EU negotiators, of course, allow this to happen. The key issue here, of course, being the Irish border, a theme which we return to further on. Moving on to number six. In contrast to widespread assumptions, the government has not produced any quantitative impact studies of the effect of Brexit on different sectors. Business, of course, are becoming increasingly concerned, and a key example here, of course, is companies that have a reliance on EU workers. So, for example, we see businesses now pressuring the Home Secretary, Amber Rudd, into expediting the release of a report on the contributions of EU migrants to the UK economy. In contrast to widespread assumptions, the government has not produced any quantitative impact studies of the effect of Brexit on different sectors. So this has become a key concern for business, as we want to see the contribution of EU migrants to the UK economy made obvious, for example. Different sectors have a different reliance. We've seen this with the NHS, where the number of EU-registered nurses, for example, coming into the UK has fallen by about 90%. And of course, the continued acute state of the NHS dominates the news at the moment, between that and Carillion, of course. So others have stepped in to try and fill the breach here. So we reiterate the Oxford Economics study, for example, that suggests $125 billion it could cost the UK by 2020. Sajid Khan, of course, the Mayor of London, commissioned Cambridge Econometrics to do a study which purported up to 500,000 jobs could be lost from the UK if we have a hard Brexit.
Moving on and continuing on that point, migration from the rest of Europe to the UK has declined by over 40% since the Brexit vote. And it's unclear, however, to what extent the referendum result and a purported climate of a less welcoming climate, let's say, have contributed to this. There are also important domestic factors within the Eurozone in particular, which have led to a fall in migration from that particular source. We've seen European economies accelerating, growth in a lot of European economies doing much better over the last 12 months than they have done previously, unemployment rates falling. The upshot of that being that it's less attractive to move to the UK. At the same time that that's happened, the sterling depreciation means that for every pound that you remit, say from the UK to Poland or to Romania, buys much less back at home than it would have done previously. So all of these are factors, and it's difficult to disentangle which ones have dominated.
I think a key stat there, though, David, is the Eurozone is outperforming the UK at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite interesting. Some of that may be cyclical. Some of that may well be Brexit related. Coming back to one of the economic studies that I alluded to earlier, they basically got a panel of countries that looked as similar as possible as to the UK and mapped what their growth had been like previously, and found that it had matched the UK economy very closely, whereas since the Brexit vote, that performance had diverged quite noticeably. Now, how much store one puts by stuff like this is difficult to say. There are one or two statistical issues that perhaps need investigating further, but it's...
Of course, the European Central Bank itself has assisted the Eurozone through its own policy of quantitative easing.
Yeah, and it's something that both the ECB and the Bank of England have engaged in quite strongly recently. It will be interesting to see what happens in the Eurozone once withdrawal of QE begins to take place. There's some tapering going on.
Moving on to number four then. Ambitions by some senior government figures, such as Trade Secretary Liam Fox, to reorient trade from the UK to the Commonwealth, or the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership, are unlikely to come to fruition, as production is shaped by geography. In other words, proximity to Europe counts for most of our key industries. If we think of the main manufacturing sectors that we have, pharmaceuticals, automotive, aerospace, and food and beverage manufacturing, the key markets for all these sectors are in Europe. Even a company such as Jaguar Land Rover, which has seen phenomenal export success to the US and China over the last 6 years, which in turn has driven, if you'll pardon the pun, the solid export performance of the West Midlands outside the Eurozone, even a company like Jaguar Land Rover still relies on the EU for a significant part of its own imported components. And of course, whilst JLR has invested in the West Midlands in Wolverhampton, in the I-54 area, and has employed thousands of engineers to, you know, cater to this increased production, it itself is hedging its bets in terms of where the next generation of electric models will be produced. And JLR, of course, has a joint venture in effect in Austria, where its electric SUV is being developed. And of course, we hear reports of them looking to expand operations in Slovakia, should it be the subject of any new trade barriers between us and the mainland. The Commonwealth, of course, accounts for less than 10% of the trade with the UK. And whilst colonial ties may seem strong, one thing we need to remember in terms of the Commonwealth is that these countries themselves have moved on after Britain joined the EU, so that the key trade partners for Australia, for example, are in its own region, namely China and Japan. Similarly for New Zealand, Canada, of course, is deeply embedded with the United States economy through NAFTA, and of course, having just signed a trade agreement with the EU means that any likely deals we get with countries such as Canada will simply piggyback onto existing arrangements with the EU. So-called grandfathering.
Picking up on that point, Alex, it's very difficult to see how the UK would reorientate itself wholesale from a supply chain or a global value chain based predominantly in Europe to one based in East Asia. It's not as if we can tow the UK halfway across the world and dump it in the Pacific Ocean. Proximity really seems to matter. And although that might go against our intuition, because trade costs obviously have fallen dramatically over the past half century, it still seems to matter a great deal, whether that's because of movement of people or whatever else.
Indeed.
Proximity matters.
Indeed, David. And if we take a company like Toyota, a global car producer, production in the automotive sector is strongly regional in focus. So only in the case of one or two models, I think the Toyota Avensis, you know, which is produced in the UK and exported, you know, globally, but these are only a small chunk of the total market. For Toyota, catering to the Asia-Pacific region, the main production hub is in Thailand. Nothing post-Brexit is going to change that. Toyota is not going to reorient its UK-based production facilities to cater to an Asia-Pacific network if we actually ended up joining a Trans-Pacific Partnership, for example.
No, and in addition to which, Thailand, I don't believe, would be a member of that. And it's not as if the UK can easily compete with a country where labour costs are perhaps most $3 or $4 per hour.
Exactly, David. So in terms of the study we did ourselves, looking at the historical patterns of trade between the UK and the Commonwealth, there's a very popular widespread belief out there that Commonwealth countries were somehow stabbed in the back or betrayed. If we actually look at patterns of trade between the UK and the Commonwealth, in terms of the percentage of trade, this had been declining long before we actually joined the EU in 1973. Whilst, you know, that proportionate decline, trade with the Commonwealth had increased in absolute terms, but the key point is that the key areas of production have become regionally based. So from that study, we would expect that even if we had a hard Brexit and trade barriers popped up in a fashion between the UK and the rest of the EU, we would not expect to see trade with the Commonwealth significantly increase. That's not to say that we shouldn't try. Indeed, for a city such as Birmingham, with strong links through its Indian and Pakistani and Caribbean communities, there may well be gains to be made from trying to exploit some of those networks. But we shouldn't think for a minute that this in any way can substitute for the important production sectors we already have with the EU.
Absolutely. Moving on to our next point then. Theresa May's red lines appear to be increasingly blurred. We've already spoken very briefly about the commitment to have due regard to the rulings of the Court of Justice of the European Union in upholding future rights of EU nationals in the UK. I'd just like to sort of focus on another statement which was made in the draft agreement, or in the stage one agreement between the UK and the EU, which is that union law is, quotes, to be interpreted in line with the case law of the Court of Justice of the European Union. So in practice, what this means is that although the UK may not be subject to what the government terms direct jurisdiction from the Court of Justice, it will remain a major legal player, and European law will to a large extent dictate the rights of EU nationals for a long time to come.
And of course, if we consider the Irish situation in particular, the status of the Irish border will largely dictate to what degree we need to keep so-called regulatory alignment with the rest of the EU.
Absolutely, and I think we'll probably come back to that in our final number one point.
So, in terms of our second most prescient or important finding, the UK government has agreed in principle to pay a large divorce bill of around £50 billion. On average, that's about £8 billion a year extra for any continued membership or transition deal with the EU beyond that. This was always going to be the case, despite statements by some politicians that the EU could go whistle or that we were under no obligation to pay this money. I think the most prescient realistic comment in this regard was given by Chancellor Philip Hammond when he said, while strictly speaking, the obligations may be questioned legally, in practice, we will have to pay what we owe, and that we cannot simply walk away from this arrangement because to do so would mean we would lose all credibility in the international financial markets and would no longer be seen as a good lender. And of course, what must be realised here is that this money does actually benefit people in the UK. It benefits them directly through the contributions to development that bodies such as the European Investment Bank make to infrastructure in this country, whether that's schools or hospitals, or assisting research and development in universities. These institutions have been some of the biggest beneficiaries of funding. And if we were to renege on payment, we would effectively be reneging on ourselves. And these institutions would then be forced with a demand by creditors to pay the money back. So that is not going to happen. It is also likely that any attempt to renege on paying a divorce bill agreed would result in a credit downgrading by international rating agencies such as Moody's, because the UK would not be seen to be a good creditor. And Philip Hammond realised this. He said, you know, we could not be seen to be a good player in the international community if we did this. Even if it builds a bridge in Slovakia, that indirectly benefits British companies and therefore British jobs, because by improving the connectivity and transport links in Europe, we improve the efficiency of our own supply chains. That benefits British companies, it benefits British jobs.
And at number one, the UK will not be able to have its cake and eat it too in negotiating any future trade deal with the EU. One of the major issues here is the Irish border, which in our opinion will largely dictate the extent to which the UK remains in the EU's regulatory orbit. One major reason for this is that the UK has guaranteed both to Ireland and to its own citizens in Northern Ireland that there will be no so-called hard border between Northern and Southern Ireland. The UK has also stated that it does not want any physical infrastructure, including customs infrastructure, ostensibly because of the risk of militant attacks on it, but also because it wishes to maintain complete freedom over the Irish border, which is such a powerful symbol of peace in Northern Ireland. In order to achieve this end, it's necessary to a large extent that regulations in Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland do not diverge. This means in practice that Northern Ireland will have to maintain a large degree of regulatory harmony with the EU, which of course Southern Ireland will remain a member of. In order to placate both the Democratic Unionist Party, which is one of the partners of Theresa May's government, but also in order to reassure the unionist community in Northern Ireland that there will be no divergence between Northern Ireland and the mainland of the UK, the agreement that the government has made with the EU so far also states that there will be no new regulatory divergence between Northern Ireland and Great Britain, unless Stormont explicitly agrees to it. This essentially, of course, gives Stormont a veto over that process. However, if there's no regulatory divergence between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, and no regulatory divergence between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, that implies to a large extent that there will be continued regulatory convergence between the UK and Southern Ireland, which again to a large extent would dictate the UK following existing EU regulations in a large number of areas.
So in other words, David, if that were to be the case, we would effectively be staying in the single market and everything but name.
To a large extent, yes. I mean, questions remain over migration in particular. Just because we need to follow European regulations does not necessarily mean that we need to adhere to the four freedoms or all of the four freedoms. You can also imagine, for example, a situation where trade in services, regulations over service trade would diverge between the UK and the rest of Europe, as long as there was no customs implication. Again, however, there's a statement within the draft agreement, within the agreement that we have so far, stating that the UK government will do nothing or will make no changes that could be seen to undermine the all-island economy. Now, that, of course, means both parts of Ireland. And if the Irish government were to argue that the UK adopting a radically different regime with respect to services would undermine their economy, that could be seen as violating that agreement. So the UK needs to tread extremely carefully here. And whilst there is scope for some divergence in a number of areas, there's also, let's say, our position has to a significant extent already been constrained by these agreements that we've made.
It's ironic then, David, that the referendum was fought on the notion of taking back control. The UK government rather candidly admitted recently that it had never lost control and that being part of the EU meant it had always had a say. But that people had simply felt like they had no say.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I would say that most people I've met, whether Leavers or Remainers, and I don't believe there's a dramatic difference between people in this regard, voted on the basis of emotions, backed up perhaps by some evidence and some facts. It's extremely difficult to and very time consuming to find out all the facts on every single different issue. So it's natural that people vote on the basis of their gut. The concern, I suppose, is that we are not taking back control, but rather giving away control, because we will no longer have a say in all of these rules and regulations that affect us. I will no longer, for example, be able to elect a member of the European Parliament. I will, however, still, perhaps, need to adhere to the laws passed by the European Union. So there's a real risk, I think, of Britain losing control.
Indeed.
Thank you both for that rundown. It was very detailed. I'd like to hone in on a couple of points made there, if you don't mind, particularly with points 9 and 6, which spoke of the unclear economic impact Brexit could have and the lack of quantitative data for the impact Brexit may have on different sectors. I know the Centre is in regular contact with local chambers of commerce and some local businesses. What have you found to be their concerns with regard to the impact of Brexit?
I think, Jess, one of the key concerns that businesses have identified consistently is that whatever the ultimate relationship of us to the UK needs to be, for a key body of membership of vehicles such as the Chamber of Commerce, just simply certainty and the uncertainty. I think if you're a business and you know what kind of trading regime you're going to face, whether you will be having to comply with World Trade Organization level tariffs in a given sector, you can plan for that. You can then do a cost-benefit analysis to see whether producing as part of an international supply chain will be unduly costly for you, whether that will force you to reconsider to do more reshoring, more producing in-house in the UK, if that's possible. The continued uncertainty in this regard is most damaging for businesses. And we saw a sort of peak of that towards the end of last year in the acute anxiety around the notion that we might not even have reached a deal on stage one. Now we're in a bit of a hiatus, of course, as we build into this second phase of negotiations to actually try and cement what the future trading relationship is going to be. That's been a key concern. Another key concern, of course, has been around the reliance on EU workers. You know, between 10-20% in some areas, such as hospitality and catering, as much as 30% per sector. So there's a real worry there in terms of the sharp drop in migration that we've seen from EU workers coming into the UK. That, of course, also spills over in the public sector, in the NHS, indeed in the sector we work in universities. So businesses have been very concerned to press the government to bring forward, you know, as I said earlier, the report on the contribution of EU migrants to the UK, and of course to try and guarantee to the extent possible that we will continue to have access to EU migrant workers. Another sector where that's become an acute concern, of course, is in agriculture, because much of the talk at the moment is around skilled migrant workers. But even those working in these so-called unskilled areas, to be honest, most of the workers there will be tertiary educated as well. They are not unskilled workers. It's just the sectors that they find themselves working in, by UK standards, are low paid, but not necessarily by standards compared to their home countries. Turning to another key sector in the Midlands, aerospace, aviation experts, for example, have warned that border checks would cost them around £1.5 billion each year. I mean, picking up on a further point, or maybe a final point, is infrastructure, and by that I essentially mean road, rail, bridges. I mean, clearly the EU is a major source of imports for us, with 62% which arrived from it last year, demonstrating how integrated Europe is in terms of our supply chains for key industries. So of course we need to be pressing for answers to make sure that a post-Brexit world allows our businesses to continue to import with minimum disruption. And of course, to the extent that we wish to see streamlined customs procedures continue, these also need to be accompanied by improved road, rail and airport infrastructure, particularly in areas such as the West Midlands where we are.
There was another point as well, about the 40% decrease in migration to the UK following the June 2016 vote. As many of our students in the city are EU or international students, I asked our BCU International Students Officer, Andrea Mihaya, and a media student from Romania about whether she believes this may put EU students off studying in the UK based on her own personal experience.
My name is Jasper Singh, a president of Birmingham City University Students Union.
And my name is Andrea Mihai, and I'm the International Students Officer at the BCUCU. Me as an international student and as a Romanian citizen that's part of Europe, I think it really affected me and all of my colleagues, because we were worried about the sponsorship that we're getting from the European Union, because us, as well as British students, we get the student loan from the government, and we were afraid that if England is gonna exit the European Union, we might not get that funding. So a lot of my friends, and I know a lot of other students, they decided not to come to England to study anymore, because they were afraid they might not get the funding during the 3 years of their studying. So a lot of them just stayed home or went to other countries where they knew it's gonna be cheaper.
Yeah.
And also I think if you're a student back home, you only see what's happening about Brexit only through media. So they don't really know what's happening here and what decisions are being made. And on the media, there's only the negative side. So that's what scares them the most.
I totally agree. And I think it's just that kind of uncertainty, whether you see, how should I say, in institutions or when you're on the streets. So it's very kind of uncertain time for the students.
I think those are valid statements. I mean, our own research through the roadshow and travelling around parts of the country have demonstrated, you know, in terms of some heavily Leave voting areas in particular, people have been quite unequivocal in stating that they voted Leave because they wanted to see migrants exit the UK, and they thought that when they voted Leave that foreigners of, you know, Eastern European persuasion would all pack up and go. So these perceptions are very acute and they're out there. So it's not surprising then that Eastern European students, for example, would be feeling more unwelcome in the UK. I mean, that the last 10 years have been notable, and of course, post-referendum, we have seen a reported upsurge in hate crimes. Public out there who have interpreted this referendum result as somehow legitimising the pre-existing, one might well say, prejudices they already had, and therefore that it was now okay for them to voice these in the open. because of the expectation that leaving the EU would mean we're going to close the drawbridge on all foreigners. Well, that is not going to happen. Migrants make a net financial contribution to the UK, and the UK needs migrant labour. The brute reality is that the UK is an ageing population, and in particular sectors of work such as care homes and construction and agriculture, British-born people simply do not want to do this work. It is hard, it is often dangerous and dirty, and it is low paid.
As found from the Brexit Roadshow.
Yes, yes. The comment by one individual who voted Leave and said that they were unemployed, would they do a job in agriculture? Their response was no.
I think it's quite natural that anyone who sees this and faces perhaps a degree of prejudice on a, or if not a daily basis, then certainly on a regular basis, would feel that way. I don't think that that's at all surprising. And obviously it's true that some people may have interpreted the vote as legitimising behaviour that they wouldn't have engaged in previously. However, I'd like to make the broader point, which is most people who voted, and even most people who voted to reduce migration, there's an awful lot of people who believe that levels of migration to the UK are too high. They are not necessarily racist. That does not necessarily on the basis of disliking foreigners or anything like that. There's a perception that the UK is unable to absorb large numbers of people. And I think we need to be quite careful not to tar all individuals with the same brush. And I think it's very easy to say, you know, as a result of the referendum, we've shown how racist we are as a country. I don't think that's true. I think that the UK is still a lot more welcoming than many other places.
As David points out, there are many reasons for that vote. Even in terms of some of the people we've spoken to about concerns over migration, if you scratch the surface, you know, as we've found, it's more to do with the notion that our public services or our communities just can't cope with the volume. But that in itself raises different questions for policy. Is it really about migration, or is it about the state of our public services?
Yeah, I mean, we've met one set of people who had their children split up and sent to different schools because there simply wasn't room. And they felt that high levels of migration into their local area were responsible for that. And that may well indeed be the case. You know, it's not unlikely that in that particular example that was true. These people are not racist. These people, they are simply responding to very, very legitimate concerns over the volume of newcomers and its impact on public services at a time when they're, relatively speaking, underfunded.
So thank you very much, Professor De Ruyter and David. You've been fantastic guests on the show. That's all for now, but if you would like any further information on the Centre for Brexit Studies, if you go over to our website, it's www.bcu.ac.uk/centre-for-brexit-studies. Thank you.
Thanks, Jess.